Welcome to Art for All, sponsored by Sketchbook School. As a thank you for joining us, I'd like to give you a free ebook and our monthly newsletter full of tips, recommendations, and other cool stuff. Just head over to sketchbookschool.com to claim your freebies and to learn more about our classes and workshops and our membership program. We believe that art is for everyone, and I hope our podcast inspires you to create and explore your own artistic journey. Thanks for listening. On with the show. Hi there. This is Danny Gregory, and you are listening to the Art for All podcast. I am a writer and an artist and a teacher and a this and a that. And every week I get together with my friend, John Muir Laws, and we talk about something to do with making stuff. Jack, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi there. I'm Jack Laws, and I am a scientist with a who explores the world often through by making images, and I'm also Danny's friend.
There you go. So this week's episode is going to focus on art supplies. Yes, we love art supplies. Hopefully you love art supplies too, and we're going to talk about the art supplies we like, the art supplies we may not like, what we use, how we've changed over time, what we would recommend you try, how we use, what we use, what we use, how we use it, and various other confusing things. It won't be confusing, though. We're going to talk about it in depth. If you want to write down some tips and suggestions, you might want to do that. We'll also put stuff in the show notes so you'll be able to find them. But this should be a lot of fun, and I'm sure we are going to fill the time easily, don't you think?
I think so. This will be a good time.
Let's get to it. So you were giving me some advice.
Well, I asked how you're doing, and there was a big sigh, and then you said, okay. And it made me think that you might be pushing yourself really hard, and just wanted to remind you about the power of taking some time out for Danny, and that if you were to do that, this community would understand.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. I tend to take on a lot of things, and then I decide that, you know, that it's time to wrap up some of them. But then instead of that time that I no longer am doing those things becoming empty time, it becomes filled with new things. So I like doing stuff. So I think that's why I end up doing a lot of things. And when I'm not doing stuff, I'm lying around thinking about what stuff I could do. So. But actually, my wife and I were having this very conversation this weekend talking about how we can, you know, figure out ways to do a little bit less. We have this fantasy called spa living, which is like we have a swimming pool, we live under palm trees, it's sunshine. If we went on vacation somewhere, it would be to a place like this. So why don't we just like use this as the place where we can be that way? But anyway, that's not the subject for today. Today we have a very important subject.
We do.
And I'm interested to see how we do it because we have to pursue the subject without being reliant on visuals.
Yes, that's right. Which is a great challenge for an art-related podcast in general.
It's true. But unless we just use the power of words to, or maybe we can have sound effects of the sounds of various art supplies being used.
Oh, so, that would be fun. Or so we could just drive, everybody nuts with just sort of saying like, you know, look really carefully at this. So if I hold the brush this way, look at that effect. Wasn't that satisfying?
Well, so, the thing is,
sorry,
the
podcast funny thing listeners.
The thing about this podcast is more people follow it on YouTube, I think, then follow it as an audio-only podcast.
Oh, so they'll know that I was just sitting here and actually not demonstrating anything.
Exactly. The cat is out of the bag. The cat is right out of the art supply bag.
Truth will out.
So our subject today is we decided we would talk about art supplies. I mean, it's certainly a subject that I enjoy pursuing, and this seems to me to be a lot to talk about.
And I'm glad we're on this because I think I'm about ready for kind of a reevaluation of my kit. So bouncing some ideas around with you would be a great thing. On a regular basis, I kind of sit down with my stuff and look at that and sort of what am I not really using and what can stay at home, and sort of make some changes in the sort of the media that I use. And I'm just at that point right now. So that would be, it would be great to kind of hear your thoughts about this, and maybe something pops into my kit for a while just because of this conversation to play with and test out.
I mean, because I'm going through also a period of reevaluation, because I want to redo my studio, and I just have a lot of stuff around me, and I want to kind of go through it all and decide like what actually needs to be on my drawing table and what can go away and what can be go completely away. It's also an opportunity to go through, like, test every pen, you know. It's always nice to like go through and go, okay, I have a feeling that half of these pens are dried out, or I don't know. So let's start by talking about pens, because I think the pens are, to me, they're kind of the backbone of what I do. And I have certainly changed my point of view about different pens many times over the decades that I've been drawing, you know.
So the pen is your sort of favorite sort of starting drawing tool, right?
Yes.
If sort of on your sort of pen desert island, what type of pen does there just happen to be a case of that washed up on the shore?
You know, that's tough, because I have different pens for different uses and different moods. I would say the pen I use probably come back to the most is the Tombow Fudenosuke. Sort of, it's a kind of somewhere between a brush and a pen. Fudenosuke.
How do you spell Fudenosuke?
Fudenosuke. I don't often spell it, but I can tell you. Let me just quickly see if I can.
There's got to be one on hand somewhere.
Okay, so yeah, there's. It doesn't actually say it. It says on it in Japanese. It's the reason that I'm hesitating. It's called a calligraphy pen. It's made by Tombow. It is the WSBH-150. It is. It's got to be a brush pen. Fudenosuke. It's got to be a way of spelling it that I. There's got to be the internet.
By the time this comes out, it will be in the show notes.
It's true. Perhaps. It will be in the show. Okay, but here's how you do spell it: F U D E N Fuden O Suke S U K E Fudenosuke. I don't know how you pronounce it. That probably isn't how you pronounce it, but that's kind of how I pronounce it. So
is this a sort of a responsive pen that where you press harder, you get a thicker line, press lighter, get a lighter line?
Big time. And it's waterproof. And there's actually two of them. There's two different kinds. This is the bluish barrel, and there's a greenish barrel. They're both black ink. The greenish barrel is a bit softer, I think. But yeah, to me, it's like it's not really a brush pen. I also like the Pentel brush pen. And there's various kinds of Pentel brush pens that I like a lot, but that's really springy. And that's like drawing with a brush. This thing is like drawing with pen essentially. But then if you push it all, you can go from very thin to like nice and squishy lines and in between. So, you know, I've gone through gazillions of pens. That's the one I like a lot. You know, I like a lot of people, I've used the Pigma Microns. I don't know if that's a pen that you use. So the Pigma Microns are, you know, they're a pretty basic drawing pen. They come in lots of different sizes and they're pretty good. They're good. But their lines tend to be pretty set, right? Yeah. If you want a fatter line, you go to a higher number. But
when I was first learning about line variation, I found it really. My brain couldn't handle the idea of like, I'm going to capture this shape and get this line variation at the same time. So I would just do a drawing with the small Pigma and then put that down and pick up a larger size Pigma and go over some of those lines and just kind of thicken them up a little bit and then go over some of those lines with an even thicker Pigma. And so that helped me kind of compartmentalize sort of the idea of line variation rather than I think it's now really cool to get it on the flow. And I think you get a more interesting looking line when you get it on the flow.
I mean, it's expressive. I think,
yeah,
I think it's sort of like, you know, sometimes a technical pen could be like, I imagine playing like a digital keyboard is, you know, right. as compared to like playing a violin where you can really, you know, they're in between notes, let's say. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I don't know how to play the violin. I don't know very much about music as a player. But I think the things that are most expressive are not either, you know, A to B to C, but they are in between those points. They are, yeah. Right? They are and a lot of them are not on purpose or planned. It's just like you feel more something. And so you push a little harder or you pull back or you just do things that, and that to me is the most interesting lines, right? As opposed to like, I mean, digital drawing, for instance, particularly earlier on when it came to digital drawing, when you do a drawing on with a mouse, let's say the line was really not expressive. The mouse was not an expressive thing to draw with. You know, it would break down into pixels. It was just ugly and mechanical feeling. And so you want to have something that expresses your humanity, and that, I mean, a brush is probably the best example of that.
Yeah. I think my go-to flexible, expressive drawing pen has been the Zebra Zensations Super Fine Tip brush pen.
Zebra. Yeah, that's a brand that we're just starting to have more and more doing. We're working with Zebra in some ways, and they're an interesting company that is more of like a office supply stuff in a lot of things that they do. But they're Japanese, I think, originally.
Yes. So this pen, sort of same deal. You press lightly, you get a super fine line, and you can get a really expressive thick one. My daughters and I call these mark pens, because the first time we saw them, they were in the hands of an illustrator friend of mine, Mark Simmons, and he was getting all these expressive lines. And I looked over his shoulder and said, "Wow, that's really cool." You know how you're impressed by somebody's artwork, but most of your brain can focus on it. Any one moment is like, oh, it must be the tool you're using. I said, that's a really neat pen. And he said, yeah, it's really great. Look at these lines it makes here. And he just turned around and he handed me his pen. He said, here, this is now yours. Just go play with it and do that. So my daughters and I call it the mark pen. And I now always try to have an extra mark pen or two in my journaling kit, so I can pull a Mark Simmons when somebody else looks over my shoulder and says, hey, that's a really, really cool pen. I can turn them around. I can turn around and say like, yeah, it's great. Here, this one's now yours. So I'm trying to spread the art supply love. I do the same thing with Pentel's water brushes, which we'll be talking about a little bit later. I find that I always have to have a few extras of those, because when people see it, they just freak out and they've got to have one. And so you can totally make somebody's day. It doesn't make your art kit that much heavier by just having a few extras of those along. And it absolutely makes somebody's day.
It's funny how you can get like really into one particular pen or one particular thing where it's like, I can't use anything but that, right? It's possible to get locked into that, and so that when you play with something else, it feels like it doesn't. It's just not right. You can't draw. It's kind of silly, because of course you can draw with anything, and it doesn't really matter. But you can really just become rigid about it.
Yeah. Fortunately, one of my favorite drawing tools is just the cheapest ballpoint pens that you can find. And you know, they're everywhere. They're in the motel lobby. They are just, you know, discarded on bus seats. And until they kind of get to that stage where they are going to just spit out random blobs of ballpoint pen ink for your hand to smudge into, they're great little responsive, very, very responsive drawing tools, because you can press hard, you can get the bold line, you go lightly, you get that light line, you can make little shades of gray with them, and they're everywhere. So because that one then got adopted into my archive of favorite drawing tools, should I lose my kit, there's always going to be one of those somewhere on hand nearby.
Yeah, do you have the ones from the bank with the chain still attached to the end of them?
that's too much of a tell.
Yeah, I remember I met James Jean, who's a really amazing artist. I'm not sure if you've ever seen his stuff, but he was drawing with these beautiful, beautiful ballpoint pen drawings, and he had a very specific type of Japanese ballpoint pen, and it became this whole thing of like, how do you find these exact pens? You can go off on these quests for particular art supplies. Like, it's only available, you know, it takes 3 months to mail to you. You can only buy them 3 at a time. All these kinds of, there are all these rules that become, that make it sort of more exotic and rare somehow.
And then there's the ones that are in the lobby of Motel 6, and you're good to go.
You have to go and you have to check into a Motel 6. It costs.
That's right.
It's expensive and elaborate. Yeah. I started out using a rollerball pen, like the Uniball. That was the first pen I drew with for years. And it's a good pen. It's nice. And the line is a little harsh to me now. I don't like it so much anymore. And occasionally it can get a bit gloppy, you know, where suddenly it can spit out some lines, and also it can sometimes take a little bit longer to dry, you know. But again, I spent so long, and then part of the reason that I got into that pen was because I just decided when I first started to draw, like, I am not going to get involved in the search for the best pen. I'm not. I'm going to force myself to just use some crappy pen, which I pulled out of the art supply closet in the office, and that's what I'm stuck with until I get to a certain point when then I'm allowed to start doing variations. But I tend to go through these kind of very Catholic phases where I'm like, there are lots of rules. And then I'll rebel against that. And there can be no rules. And I'll draw with anything. But yeah.
And you find yourself in the Motel 6.
Exactly. What about fountain pens? Have you ever used fountain pens to draw with?
For the longest time, I thought of fountain pens as just the blot and bleeder kind of pens that my dad had,
right?
And so lumped those all in together until somebody just sort of mailed me one of these just inexpensive preppy fountain pens and said, Jack, just try it. And
they're not preppy. It's just the brand is called Preppy. It's a Japanese brand, right?
Yes.
Preppy.
But it says Preppy on the side, made in Japan. And that's a really, really solid pen. I was actually just drawing with it right before our podcast started and just thinking like, oh, that feels nice. It feels good. I've been told by fountain pen people about the Lamy pens. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
Lamy Safari, yeah.
Yeah, the Lamy Safari. So I got myself a Lamy Safari, which promptly clogged, and I haven't been able to figure out how to unclog it. And so it may be a great pen, but I haven't experienced that because the one that I have just decided to stop up, and I haven't had the motivation to go fix that because the Preppy, which is a less expensive pen, just seemed to be, it was flowing. And so I just went with that. So I haven't had the full Safari experience.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that happened to you. I did a workshop, taught a workshop on using fountain pens, and we did a whole demonstration about how to clean them and break them down. It's pretty simple.
I've taken this thing apart, the Safari apart, pulled all the pieces apart, was flushing it with bulb syringes, and
did you take the nib off?
Yes, I got my nib off, and but still, she won't flow.
Yeah, I mean, what did? And were you just using like a cartridge, a regular cartridge?
Yes.
So, okay. Yeah, because, you know, with fountain pens, you can get a thing called a converter, which plugs into where the cartridge goes, and then you can put in any kind of ink. But not any kind of ink. There's certain kinds of, if you put India ink into a fountain pen, it'll destroy it immediately. There are definitely different kinds of inks. And one of the things that people wrestle with fountain pens is waterproofness, because most fountain pen inks are not waterproof. And if you do a drawing and then you watercolor over it, of course, it'll be a disaster if you don't have waterproof ink. But there are ways of getting waterproof ink. In fact, on Sketchbook Soul's channel, we have several videos addressing this subject, because it's a big hot subject for people. But I like fountain pens a lot. I like the Lamy Safari. I own about 10 of them, in part because there are three different nibs, and they're not expensive. I think they're less than $20, but they're really hardy. And you can have different colored ones. You can have different colored inks in them. They are sort of the VW Beetle of fountain pens by and large. So, and I like a nice fat nib, and I think the Preppy has a kind of a thinner, scratchier nib, from what I remember.
Yeah, there's the Extra Fine and the Fine. Those are the ones that I have. The Extra Fine, I tried it and didn't like it. The Fine, well, I got a little duck going here with it, and it seems to be just going along. But I don't have something really to compare it to. You know, there's a huge difference when you're kind of able to get several things side by side and kind of line them up and see that, you know, this one works this way, this one works this way, this one smudged, this one didn't. That's something that I love about that JetPens website, where
JetPens.com. It is,
they're brilliant. They'll do those side by side comparisons for you of, you know, what are the least smudgy ballpoints? Whatever it is, the kind of questions which we ask, they will geek out hard on those things. And like, okay, here is the most opaque white gel pen. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's great. They're like the Consumer Reports of
yes. That's exactly right. That's how I think of them.
But also, yeah. I mean, a thing that you learn over time is that pens, ink, react really differently in different kinds of paper. And you can have a pen that the waterproof quality of it completely changes because you've changed the paper, because of the sizing, which is the kind of stuff that paper manufacturers put on paper to make it either absorb or not absorb paint and water. All those kinds of things, those are variable too. So you can have a pen that works perfectly normally, does everything it's supposed to do, and then suddenly you get a new sketchbook and everything goes to hell. So, you know, all the things that you might have figured out about the pen, it's good to try it out. If you get a new sketchbook, to take like the last page and just devote it to swatching and trying out all your different pens and watercolors and stuff like that, to see how they function.
I've never done that, but that's a really good suggestion. It also then kind of breaks in that new sketchbook a little bit. And sometimes it's intimidating to jump into a new sketchbook. But, you know, you can take that last page and you can turn it into a project page. And then the whole sketchbook is a little bit less intimidating. And if it still is too intimidating, then I always suggest to people to start on page two. But you might not have to do that if you turn the back page into something that's useful already.
Draw first blood, as they say. But also, yeah, and the first page of your sketchbook, by the way, should have your name and some way to contact you.
Oh, yeah.
That's have you right. had that have experience?
I've lost them and had them come back because it was there. And I've also lost them without that in it.
Exactly.
The rookie move.
I left a beautiful sketchbook on a plane because I had it like sitting next to me against the armrest. And then, you know, deplaned, and then realized later on that it was gone. And yeah, so there's that. But yeah, definitely it's most, of course, if somebody finds a sketchbook and there is a way to get in touch with you, you know, unless they were like completely horrible, pathological people, they would definitely drop you an email or send you a text. So
it's worth it. But they also might just fall madly in love with you because it's such an intimate kind of vision into your life and your world. They'll be like, oh, wow, I really, really want to meet this person. You know, it's such a treat to look through other people's journals. And can you imagine being the person who finds somebody else's sketchbook? And it's like,
I mean, it's like finding someone's child or something like that. I think you would feel really terrible that this person didn't, it clearly not meant to lose this thing. So yeah, that's a really important thing to do. And so what about when it comes to sketchbooks, are you a one sketchbook at a time man?
I tried the multiple sketchbook things and found it more of a distraction. Like, which one am I supposed to use? If there's, you know, sometimes if there's one sketchbook and it's possible for me to bring it with me everywhere, I do that. But I also do have a whole sketching system in my car. So if I'm ever bopping along and I see something that needs to have the sketchbook brought out on it, and I don't have my regular kit, I'm not in trouble. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, the amount of gas that it has consumed just carrying it around with me when I don't use it is insignificant. So
now wait, what do you mean by a system? What does that mean?
Well, these are a few of my favorite things, a little kit with my favorite things in it.
And so, you leave it in the car.
And it rides around in the car. And then I've got the same, that's actually, I've got a set of supplies in my studio that are the exact same things that I bring with me into the field. And then I have a mini me version of that that rides around in my car in case I don't have those things. So that way when I sit down in my studio, I open up my palette. I know each one of those little blocks of paint. I know where they sit relative to each other. My brush knows where to go. I use the same kinds of brushes so that, you know, that also is kind of a consistent experience. If I've got something that I really like, I want to have it with me out in the field. And I just sort of use the same. What I did originally is I just had one kit and I would use that in my studio and then use that out in the field. But then I discovered what I would do is I would get out in the field and realize I left the pencil on the table. And then there you are and you don't have your pencil. You've left your water brush on the table. And there you are. Now you're in the field and there's the duck and there's no brush. So then that's why I kind of started kind of the duplicate system, the one that I carry on my hip and the one that sits in the studio. But then there is a mini me version that rides in the car.
So what now when it sits on your hip, what is it in? What do you keep your stuff in?
So that I think is an important part of the kit because if your stuff is, think about it in terms of kind of operant conditioning, right? If there is negative reinforcement between you and getting your nature journaling stuff out, you're going to do it less. If you have to kind of root around the house and get all your supplies, you're less likely to bring all those supplies with you out in the field because it's a hassle to kind of go get those things together. And then when you're out in the field, if it's a hassle to go like, oh, there's a duck I'd like to draw. Now I have my journaling things in my hand and I'm drawing. If that's smooth, you're going to do it all the time. But if you have to kind of root around in the backpack and like, where's the palette? And then over here is the sketchbook and move the poncho and the lunch. And oh dear, the water bottle kind of leaked a little bit. And, you know, by this point, the bird's flown away. So what I like to do is have everything in a kind of handy portable pouch that just sits on my hip. So I want a shoulder bag, not a backpack, because the backpack is for lunch and the shoulder bag, I can put my hand down in it. I can grab it. And in seconds, I'm journaling. And if it's in the backpack, you know, then it's much more of a production to both get it out and put it back away. But if it's right there on my hip, I can reach in, grab it, get my journal on, then put it back in and I'm trotting on down the trail. And I'm not thinking like, oh, do I really want to kind of go through getting that out right now? That's kind of a, all that is, that energy, that thinking is a barrier to between you and journaling more. So that's what I'd like to have.
First, when he was saying on your hip, I was like, oh my God, I hope he's not going to say this like a fanny pack. That would be seriously uncool. But a shoulder bag is okay. Shoulder bag's fine. Sounds like you need a holster. Sounds like you need like a speed loading.
So, yeah, I actually think of it as a quick draw system.
Yeah.
So I've sometimes been out with some of my nature journaling buddies, and we sort of talk about kind of the idea of the quick draw nature journal, and we'll go, on your mark, get set, draw. And so when you say draw, you get all your stuff out. You want to have your favorite thing in your hand, open to the next blank page, and your journal in sort of sketching position. Like how much time does it take to get into to draw your journal?
Sketch draw McClaws, yeah.
That's right. So you get your journal out, and then poof, it goes right back in. And it's goofy and it's fun and that's okay.
So yeah, I mean I have various things. When I go out, I don't go into nature journaling so much, but when I do urban sketching, for instance, or if I'm travel journaling, I do have a backpack. I tend to carry it on one shoulder, but I've had shoulder bags and they're okay. I mean, I totally agree with you that it's easier to just be able to dip in rather than having to pull it off and go through it. I got this special backpack from jetpens.com. In fact, it's a Japanese backpack that's very light and has a gazillion pockets. When you have a lot of pockets, then you can kind of get to things quickly. And so you can have like your quick draw stuff like in one pocket that you can just grab and pull out. Yes. And then you can have like, you know, deeper pockets where you put, you know, other stuff and coats and snacks and things like that. So, you know, it's okay. I mean, I also sometimes take a stool, mm-hmm. folding mm-hmm. stool. And so that's it's nice, so nice to have. Yeah. It's nice to be able to have like a attachment kind of in your backpack or like a sleeve or something like that, that it slides into. I've tried different ones. There's like the kind that are just three sticks that kind of telescope out. I tried a Coleman camping stool, which is the most compact, but you're sitting sort of like 3 inches off the ground. You feel like a bit of a dork. And I remember at one point I was doing a bit of fair amount of car drawing. And I had like a full-on folding chair with cup holders, which were actually kind of good because you could put a water thing in. You could have, mm-hmm. you know, and you could have armrests, which were really nice. But that only works if you have a car, because otherwise it's ridiculous. You're walking around carrying like, you look like sort of a homeless person who's, you know, got a whole. I mean, it's possible to have too many art supplies and too much stuff with you.
Yeah, so if you're pushing the Barca lounger in front of you. your gear may be getting just a little bit too bulky. Because what's going to happen is if you start to have too many art supplies, at some point you're going to go say, I'm going to go for a walk. Do I want to bring this stuff? And then you go like, I'm just going to leave it behind this time. Because it's just too much of a hassle to bring all that stuff with you. But if it's just easy to grab and go. Yeah, so for my bag, I looked around for the right bag for a while and ended up contracting with a company called Flowfold and designed what I thought the sort of my ideal bag would be with them. And they then produced that for my store. And so we'd get these really fun prototypes that we'd then bring out to our Nature Journal Club field trips, where we'd have, you know, 30 nature journalers, and we'd dissect the bag and we kind of look at it like, you know, and different people would try it on and put their stuff in it. Like, no, it doesn't fit this kind of sketchbook. Like I want a pouch here. And so we kind of tweaked it and modified it and kind of came up with a design that I really like. And so that's kind of been the bag that, it may not be the right bag for other people, but it's definitely the right bag for me because I got to sort of add features, take features away until I went, this is it.
That sounds very nice to have your own customized bag. Very good. I was thinking about John Ruskin, you know, the 19th century sort of writer and painter and stuff like that. He He had a manservant who would carry his stuff and a folding chair and hold an umbrella over him while he painted.
Wow, so, that's...
Yeah. So he painted like in Venice. And I think he had, at times, he had a donkey also just to carry stuff. But you do that.
The nice thing about having the donkey is that, you know, if nothing else, you can pet the donkey.
Draw the donkey, yeah.
Draw the donkey. You can also pet the donkey, give it a carrot. I mean, that would be fun to have a little donkey out there with you. Possibly, and that would also be, you know, a great sort of, you know, conversation starter.
I think you should get
one. To check out your donkey.
I think you should get one.
I think I need a donkey. And I'll send you, I'd love to see what you think of it. I'll send you one of the bags that we made.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. If I ever go anywhere, it would be very handy.
Should you ever? Yeah. I found it for the, one of the sort of ideas that I have about stuff is that I want to regularly go through my pile of stuff and cull it and sort of pick out the stuff that is, that I'm not really regularly using. That just kind of keeps the whole system lighter. And so I find if I have the same is true with backpacks. If I have a big backpack when I'm going camping, I will find an excuse to fill up that entire backpack. If I have a smaller backpack, and so I do now most of my backpacking is sort of ultralight backpacking. It's a very small, it's a very lightweight backpack. And because it is small and lightweight, I can only put a little bit of stuff in it. And so I'm very selective about what stuff goes in. And the minute you get the bigger backpack, then the bigger backpack needs to be, you know, even more strongly reinforced because you're going to be putting more stuff in it. You know, back in the day, I was, you know, I took pride and I have a 60-pound pack. You know, I took pride in that. And now I look at it, that's crazy. That's nuts.
That's a lot. But unless you have a manservant, that's not.
Or the donkey. See, the donkey. I was missing the donkey. I really need the donkey. The donkey will carry my umbrella.
Because I remember when I went on a trip, my wife and I drove from Seattle to LA, and we spent like 2 weeks driving all the way down the West Coast. And I was getting ready to teach a watercolor workshop. So I had a whole bunch of like different ideas of different kinds of watercolors I wanted to try. And people had been sending me all these different watercolor things to try out. And I had watercolor markers and I had like just all kinds of different things. And so I ended up getting one of these giant North Face duffel bags that has wheels and like a handle. And I filled, because I knew we were renting a car. So I was like, we're going to rent a car. You know, there's no limit to how much I can take. As long as, you know, I'm underneath the baggage allowance, tell with it. I'm just going to do that. So I brought this in huge bag. My wife was bitterly complaining about it the entire time, in part because also it was in the summer. And I thought, we're in the summer. It's the West Coast of the United States. It's going to be warm. I'm not going to need much. I'll just have some t-shirts and some shorts. Well, it turned out that no, it's freezing up there. So I hadn't any room in my bag.
Where was your workshop?
Well, my workshop I was going to teach when I came back. It wasn't there. The trip. So we went from Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and we worked our way down. But a lot of it was, I mean, this is in August. I thought it's August. I'm used to New York August when it's a zillion degrees.
You had a San Francisco summer.
It was terrible. And so yeah. I ended up actually going to a thrift store like the second day we got there and buying like a weird hoodie from some high school and wearing it basically the entire trip. The reason that I didn't have any clothes really was because I had this huge duffel bag full of art supplies. And so I can't take much more with it. So. Yeah, so it was a disaster. And then actually for about 2 years after that, I only ever took an iPad with me when I traveled. So that was kind of the other end of it. But I have to say, a lot of times I also like having a lot less just because it's more creatively challenging, honestly, to have like three pens, you know, six mm-hmm. colored pencils, a small, I, a lot of times I like to travel with a small Moleskin watercolor book, the smallest one, which is like 3x6 or something, 3x5. And so you're working in much more limited circumstances, and that's going to make you, you know, figure stuff out and improvise. It's also fun when you're traveling to be able to have room to go and buy art supplies. So you can go to like weird art supply stores in foreign countries and see new stuff, and you have an excuse to buy something.
Yeah, and that ties into the whole idea of over-choice or choice overload. When you've got all these different pens, you then end up thinking to yourself like, this one or that one? Or this one or that one? You know, they've done these kind of interesting psychological tests where, you know, if you give people, you go up to the buffet and there are 30 different types of salad dressing. We actually are not happier with that. People end up kind of, well, I guess I'll use this one. But then you're thinking, maybe I would have been happier if I had chosen that other one. But if there's just a few choices there, then you go like, oh, this is the kind I like. And then you stick that on your salad and boom, you're happy. So you actually, too much choice can paralyze us. And it's so nice when your hand goes down into your little sketch bag and your fingertips touch that pencil and you know there are just three pencils in there and you know which one that is and you pull out the right one rather than having to like that one, no, not that one. Oh, do I really want that one? Like, oh, what would, I haven't used this one in a while. So you don't want to kind of get paralyzed by too much choice. So that having fewer items out there, I think actually makes it for a more pleasurable experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for a long time I would work in this moleskin, which was literally the size of my phone. Mm-hmm. I could put my phone on top. I have a fairly large phone, but so I had that. I had one pen. Often it would be this Fudensuke, or it might be like a kind of a mid-range Micron, like an 02 or 03. I would have a water brush, which we'll talk a bit about in a second. And I would also, I made a little teeny tiny, if you're watching this on video, you can see this was my watercolor set.
I'm looking at a little tiny, like one of the, maybe it's like not this, a mini Altoids tin.
It's basically that. It's like 2 inches by 1 inch. And it is, you know, perfectly serviceable. If you have good quality watercolors, they're pretty dense. And so that will last.
I see a little kit. He opened it up. It's got eight little wells that could each hold.
And has a little bit of gouache.
Three or four drops of liquid.
Enough for easily a day's painting. Easily a day's painting with good professional level things. So you take that. That will fit into the watch pocket of your jeans. And then you put the pen and water brush in your front pocket. You put the sketchbook in your back pocket. You're done. And then you use your jeans to clean your brush. So that's all.
Jeans to clean your brush. That's good.
Yeah. So you don't need to carry anything. So water brush, for those of you who don't know, is, again, we shouldn't be doing this on video, but I'm going to show it anyway. This is a rather dirty one, but it's basically a plastic brush with a soft plastic handle that you can fill with water. Or in this case, I've actually filled it with India ink. And then, you know, you have water with you wherever you go. I mean, it's a transformative tool because it means you don't have to have a water jar that can leak. You don't have to fill it up somewhere. You don't have to carry any of that stuff. You just use your water brush.
I absolutely agree. It is an absolute game changer. And also, I think it's a more ecologically, it's sort of better way to kind of get your paint on. So back in the day when you kind of get that jar of mucky water, you'd bring a little jar with you. As you paint, it gets increasingly gunky.
Right.
And then what you do when it's gunky is most people just pour it out wherever they are and fill more water in from their canteen.
Oh, right.
Well, if you're doing painting with cobalts and cadmiums and all these sorts of things, you've just made a little jar of toxic waste.
Right. And you're dumping it in a trail or something like that.
Yeah. You're dropping that in the middle of Tuolumne Meadows. Ah, right. So what are you going to do? You're going to pack that out really? Probably not. So, but with the water brush, what my instead of using my jeans, I will take a, I have a sock, you know, those little dryer orphans. You can put, get a part of a sock and you put it over your wrist, like a wrist warmer. So I'm right-handed. So I'll put the sock on my left hand. So my brush, right hand holds my brush. My left hand holds my palette and it has the sock on it. When I want to change colors, I give the brush a squeeze and a wipe on that sock. And I'm good to go. Cleans the brush from the inside. You don't need a ton of water.
Right, because you push water through it. You squeeze it a couple times. It pumps water through the brush.
Boom.
Wipe it off. Yeah. I mean, I've seen people use sweatbands. Same concept. Yep.
Sweatbands. Yeah. But those dryer orphans, they're good. Don't show it.
No, this is a purely visual
audio. Can't show. All right, I'll tell instead of show that what for sock 2.0, somebody sent me googly eyes that I attached to the sock, so it also serves as a sock puppet.
Love that. So you can use it to attract birds or something too.
Because you know how often are you out there? Think to yourself, gosh, if I only had a sock puppet right now.
I only had a friend.
You'd be surprised how often a sock puppet comes in handy when you've actually got a sock puppet with you.
Exactly. that's very useful. I never thought of that. I have a Welsh pub towel that I usually carry around with me when I don't want to soil my jeans. So I picked it up.
So favorite water brush?
Well, for a long time I used the Niji's. Niji, that was the one. And then there's the Pentels. And then also recently I've been seeing the Derwent ones.
I haven't tried those yet.
Yeah, the Derwent looks a little bit more substantial. You know, I think a lot of watercolor purists wouldn't like these, maybe because the brushes are synthetic. You know, it's not like you have a, you know, beautiful Kolinsky Sable.
Right. What a brush. Not Series 7 Kolinsky Sable.
Right. But nobody really cares that much about it. And, you know, I have a Series 7 Kolinsky brush. I can always throw it in the bag if I really, in case I run into any watercolor snobs, I can pull it out. But yeah. So water brushes. So do you have any, do you care? I mean, I don't really care what the brand is. I bought no-name ones. They're fine.
I'm a big booster of, like, my number one go-to brush is the Pentel Aquash Large Fine Point Water Brush. And so they come in several sizes. I use the large one, which snaps to a perfectly sharp point because you can also do a big wash with it. And that little water brush makes me so happy.
They're hard to throw away, though, I find. Like, I have like a whole jar of them. Yeah, this one could still be used for something. It's like old toothbrushes or something. You never know.
I find that mine tend not to get old because I'll be out there painting and somebody will come up to me and they'll say, like, oh, I love that brush.
And so you just sell it.
And I can say, here. So no, just on the spot, you just hand them your brush. And you say, yeah, this is an absolute game changer. Here's a couple of things on how it works. Get yourself a little dryer orphan sock and then do this. And here, this brush is for you.
$30.
So you give them your brush and then you've totally made their day. This stranger who they met by the side of the trail just gave them
brush man.
The ultimate water brush. And you happen to have an extra one inside your kit because you need to go do more painting that day. So you carry some extra mark pens and you carry some extra water brushes. And that is huge.
This podcast is not sponsored by Pentel yet.
No, it's not. Yeah. My favorite one is the Kuretake Fude water brush pen with a flat head. And that one is, so it's a, you can have a, it sort of comes as sort of a chisel shaped head.
So it's like a wash, almost like a wash brush.
Well, there's a flat head.
Oh, I see.
It is sort of, imagine sort of a chisel shaped brush. And that's cool. But wait, there's more because the tip of it has a little plastic ferrule on it and you can pop that off. So then the whole thing is a big mop head So it's two brushes in one.
I see. So you slick.
But wait, there's more. Because when you put that little, it's sold as a two-in-one brush, but it's actually three-in-one. Because instead of snapping off that little outside part, if you spin it, then what happens is the tip of it turns into this crazy squirrel tail, multi-headed, pointed brush that you can use for kind of, you know, a hair detail, texture, grasses, all these sorts of things. And then you can pop that off again, flatten it out, and it goes back to being a chisel-shaped brush. So it's got in one brush head these three things. And you're thinking, at first people are thinking like, you know, when am I going to really use it like a chisel-shaped brush? I'm not going to be like drawing bricks with this. No, you're not. But you can actually get wonderful, very irregular patterns by putting these brushes down and kind of dancing them back and forth as you're painting. You can get effects that look much more, you get effects that are much more random than right. if you're doing it without that sort of chisel effect.
That's a good tip.
So that's good. It's this 3-in-1 brush, and they sell it as 2-in-1. They don't, the people who sell this brush don't know about that kind of twist the head and turn the point into this multi sort of like, imagine if you, a squirrel put its little toe into a light socket and, you know, all the hairs were standing out. You kind of get this sort of all the hairs standing out effect by twisting the tip of that.
We do not recommend that you put squirrels' feet into electrical.
That's right.
Just yeah, saying.
No squirrels were harmed in the production of this podcast.
Exactly. So here's another.
Do not endorse being mean to squirrels.
Another tool that we haven't talked about, which I don't know if you use at all, but is a big one for me, is the dip pen.
So you know, I don't have dip pen chops. I would love to hear about your experience with dip pens, how you use those, what you use those for. And what, so tell me, sort of break this down for me. Like, why do I want a dip pen? Because my brain jumps to like, do I want a bottle of ink out there with me? I'm going to be spilling my ink. And then, so the dip pen.
No, those are all legitimate questions. So, I mean, dip pens have been used for thousands of years and people still use them. And there's a lot of reasons for it. So a dip pen is a metal nib stuck into usually a wooden handle, and there are thousands of variations in nib types, nib materials, nib widths, nib usages. Again, it's like this really deep, mature category. So there's all these different special uses. A lot of them exist in the calligraphy world, calligraphy and lettering, because you can, you know, get effects and use nibs for all different kinds of things. The nib I recommend that people try and probably will stick with is called the G nib. And it is, Zebra actually makes G nibs. It's called G because the side of it is kind of G shaped. It has these like little prongs that stick out that make a G. And it's a good nib to start with because it is pretty easy to control. That's, I think, a lot of the times people's fears about dip pens is you can't control it. It splatters. You can't.
Yeah, that's my what I envision with the dip right. pen out there.
So the dip pen is, first of all, to draw with India ink is just so beautiful. I mean, India ink, wet India ink, black. It's such a black line. It's so next level in terms of the blackness of it. It's also when it's dry, it's waterproof. The G nib, you can get super fine lines. And then with a bit of pull, you can get a really big fat line and everything in between. So it gives you that incredible flexibility. It's also really, really responsive to your hands. So in some ways, it can feel like a living thing. Like it has a responsiveness. It's like a living thing. I feel like I love, and so many artists who I love have always drawn with dip pens. Comic book artists and illustrators and cartoonists have always used dip pens just because they're, and again, that's using them, you know, usually at a drawing table or indoors, you know, so then you have the whole, what do I do in the field thing? I don't draw with them that much, but I write with them all the time. So when I write with a dip pen, the writing is just beautiful because, again, you can get incredibly expressive lines. And to me, it's like the finishing touch to my journal pages is always going in and writing with the dip pen. So when it comes to working in the field, one thing that I've got is a block of wood, a square block of wood that has four fat holes drilled into it. And in each hole is a little kind of cartridge with a screw cap. So it's probably holds, you know, half an ounce of ink. And you unscrew it and you have it in the wooden block. So it's not going to tip over. And because it's in this plastic thing, it's fine. And then you can dip the pen. You just need to dip the pen into the ink and it works fine. And you can use that anywhere. It's, you know, you can carry it in your pocket. You can carry just the nib in your pocket, just the thing in your pocket. But it's also, you know, dip pens are really inexpensive. You know, a nib costs like a buck or two. A handle costs maybe $4 or $5. And, you know, you can get them in lots of different places. But once you get into it, there's so many. It's like a whole elaborate world that you can get into drawing with a dip pen.
But maybe start for the starter like me. I might
G-nib.
Kind of
go to the G-nib.
The G-nib.
I don't think you'll ever need anything but the G-nib, honestly. It does so much. And, you know, you buy a package of them. They come like 8 or 10 in a box because you want to change them every month or two. They're like kind of like razor blades. You want to change them. And it's, you know, it takes a bit of practice to learn how to pull a line, how to draw a line. Sometimes if you're doing it the wrong angle, it can kind of stammer and, you know, get away from you a bit. Yeah, I mean, I personally love the splatters. To me, that's part of the fun of it. So, you know, I think it's if you can spend, you know, a day or two practicing. And also the great thing about it is like if you want to learn how to draw with a dip pen, there are really great drawing instruction books that were written 100 years ago that are completely relevant. You know, there's some really
those old great drawing manuals are so exactly, brilliant.
Exactly. So you can look at those and you're part of that. You feel like you're part of this continuity, you know, you're not just using the newest dang fangled thing, you know, and honestly, there are people who draw with crow quills, which is a very fine type of nib, but also there are people who literally take a feather and cut the end of it and make it into a nib. You know, you just cut it at an angle, you split it, and then it's suddenly, it is a pen. So what could be cooler than drawing a bird with its feather?
Yeah, with an actual quill of a crow.
Yeah, thing to think about. I mean, it also slows you down in some ways, which I think improves your drawing. It also has a built-in breathing mechanism because you dip your pen, you draw, pen runs out, and then you go back and you dip. So it forces pauses, which I think are also helpful in your drawing. So
just reminds me of kind of part of the journaling kit of one of my real watercolor inspirations is a woman named Lori Wiggum. And part of her kit is a pocket knife. And she'll get out there and she'll find, you know, she'll be in a certain kind of forest and she'll pick up a twig. She'll whittle a little nib for herself and she'll dip that branch into the and so she'll draw that forest with that forest.
I love that.
And there's something really wonderful about that.
I love the quality of it too. Like if you look at Van Gogh drawings, he did them all with a reed pen, you know, and they have this kind of like, there's a certain kind of bluntness to a reed pen. It's not flexible at all. You know, again, and you're constantly having to re-dip. It doesn't have a reservoir that holds much. Similar to your friend drawing with a branch or a twig. I have a friend who draws with a chopstick, similar kind of thing. He just dips it in. Another thing you can do with a dip pen is if you have a small bottle of ink, you take some gauze and you roll the gauze in and you stuff it into the ink bottle. And so again, that's a way of it won't tip over and flood, but you can still get enough ink out of it every time. So it's just sort of a way of controlling it. Yeah. So let's move on and talk about colored pencils. Do you use colored pencils?
I think colored pencils are great. And either as a standalone thing or put down a layer of watercolor, let that watercolor dry. You've got to let that watercolor dry. And then go over the watercolor with those colored pencils allows you to get another level of
richness,
detail and texture on top of the saturated color that you got with your watercolor.
Right. Yeah, it's great to have that wash, and it fills in like the line, so you don't necessarily have to like scrub your whole colored pencil over. You can have the that, as you say, the textured quality of the pencil, and yet it's got a background of color, which is so nice. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes mm-hmm. of a contrasting color too.
And the big secret is let that page dry completely, because if it's even just a little bit damp, then your pencil, instead of going across the surface, leaving little particles of pencil color, it's just going to emboss down into the paper and mess with your paper texture and surface. And you'll be sad. You think, I don't like these two together. But once it's dry, it just works so well on top of that watercolor.
Do you use watercolor pencils?
I've messed with watercolor pencils some. My big beef with the watercolor pencils is that very often I will mix a color looking at the pencils. And then when I hit it with water, it turns into something so much more kind of vibrant-y, chartreuse-y, totally, like, I did not see that coming. That is not what I expected that to be. The Albrecht Dürer pencils, are they Derwent? Albrecht Dürer watercolor pencils. Those ones tend, Faber-Castell, I think, they tend to be a little bit less surprise color change on me, but still that bothers me. So my workaround with that, when I do use watercolor pencils, and sometimes I do, but what I used to do, which didn't work for me, is I would essentially do a colored pencil drawing and then hit that colored pencil drawing with the water. And then these big changes would happen, and any details you put in just got destroyed and you're sad. But where I have had success with it is to sort of think about it in stages. Sort of stage one, lay in some local color. And where I will use those colored pencils, just like a colored pencil, I'll put in sort of a coat of color, hit that with my water brush and liquefy the color. Then let that dry, then come back on top of that dried coat that blocked in that color, and now draw detail on it. But don't hit that detail with water. Here I'm doing any color correction as well. Don't hit that final version with watercolor because of the surprises that it gives me. So I do like watercolor pencil when I first can block in color, hit that with water, make a base coat, then use it as dry pencil on top of that. What's your experience with it?
Well, we just had a watercolor pencil workshop at Sketchbook School. We had a woman who is the president of the sort of some divisional part of the watercolor of the Pencil Artist Association of America, something like that it's called. Anyway, she taught us all kinds of things, most of which I'm not going to give away in this podcast, but they were pretty fascinating. But definitely, you know, she talked about different ways of activating the watercolor pencil, so you do have more control of it, layering it, the sequence of colors that you put down. In other words, you can't just slap down any color. Like with regular watercolors, you know, you might want to start lighter and then build your way up to dark. And, you know, there is definitely an art to it. It is an incredible medium. I mean, the things that she does, you realize, like, if you know what you're doing, you can do just about anything with these things. Mm. I think the vibrancy of the colors would attract me the most to it. I love Derwent Inktense colored pencils. They also have these kind of sticks that you can get. And that color is just, you know, short of a marker, it's about the brightest, most intense colors you can get. And I really love that. But I learned so much from her that I need to now apply and practice with, to see how you build and build and build, and then also how you use erasers as another tool to use creatively, not to erase stuff, but to like knock things back, to open up, you know, light areas and do variations. And she also did spend a lot of time on doing like a final polish to the drawing that made huge differences, like adding darks and sharpening things up and sharpening things so that they just became almost photographic. It was really extraordinary. And I learned a huge amount about it. So that's I feel like that's a medium that I've played with for years, but I now realize if I applied myself to it, I could, and really focus on it, I could take it to the next level. I could make it into a
huge. I guess I didn't have any. All my kind of experience with it has just been by trial and error. And
same here. That's what happens when you learn from a pro and you go, oh, that's how you do that thing. Oh, I had no idea that that's what that was. And then you can do it. So yeah, she taught us a lot about that. I mean, I think I like also combining lots of media into the same thing. So taking something like doing watercolor, we have an artist who's taught for us a number of times named Ian Fennelly, and he does watercolor wash, and then he'll take like a gray brush marker and he'll use that for adding tone on top of the watercolor. And then he'll use a range of different kinds of line making pens, fine liners, to kind of get deeper and deeper. And he'll just keep layering stuff, and things get more and more interesting. More and more detail comes out of it.
Oh, that's fun.
And then going in with like a white pencil or a white gel marker and, you know, adding more highlights. It's really this process of layering that can transform an ordinary drawing into something really cool.
And you bring up there the white pencil and the white gel pens. Those are kind of in the part of my kit that I try to keep at my fingertips. So I've got two sections. I've got the stuff which I use 90% of the time. And then sort of deeper in the kit, there is a zipper bag that has everything else. And so my hands go in and they can pick that little handful of pencils. One of the things that's in there is the white gel pen and the white Prismacolor pencil. I'll use those just to add a little bit of light on any subject that I do. Once the drawing's essentially completed, sort of last step for me is often to kind of come in. And I think of those as sort of being, you know, light captured in wax or ink. And then you come in and just sort of be the light and you can put those in.
Yeah. You can turn the lights on. It's like, you can put a drop of a highlight into an eye and suddenly it comes alive. Right.
Yes.
So, and the kind of thing that if you were trying to like leave white space, white paper by, you know, no, but you just hit it with a gel marker. And, yeah, it's alive. It's really cool that way. Another thing I've been quite into is watercolor markers. I don't know if you've ever tried those. But
I have zero experience with those.
So yeah, so Winsor Newton makes a nice line of them. I also like Echoline makes these brush pens that are just so juicy. And again, because they're watercolor, they don't bleed through your page like a regular alcohol-based marker does. Mm-hmm. They're
that
watercolor
nuts.
Yeah, of course. So, and although there is a type of sketchbook called Render, R-E-N-D-R, which is, you can draw on a Sharpie on it and it doesn't bleed through. It's designed, you can't really use wet media on it, but it is designed for that. But these watercolor markers, you can layer them. You can do all kinds of things that you can do with watercolor. So you can draw with it, just like with a watercolor pencil, where you can activate it and blend it with another color. It's also just a pure color. So you can lay down like a flat area of it really easily. It works like a marker. So I think having two or three of those in your kit is not a bad idea.
What colors would you grab if you're just
but I would think like having, you know, greens for foliage or something like that would be smart, you know, or having maybe, you know, like the Payne's gray marker. I love that so much. It's really beautiful to draw with. And it's also just, you know, Payne's gray, it's just the most beautiful gray,
and
I think.
And so these are, who makes these watercolor markers?
Well, the watercolor markers are made by Winsor & Newton. So, you know, they know watercolors. And then this other brand that I was talking about before is called Echoline, Ecoline. And they make a whole line of these brush pens the company that owns them is called Royal Talons, which is a German company. But those Echolines, really fun to just draw loosely with. If you like doing big, loose, kind of playful drawings, they're really fun.
And they've got the Payne's gray one.
Payne's gray is Winsor Newton.
That's the Winsor Newton.
Yeah.
The Payne's gray is a great color.
Yeah. I mean, I have Again, I'm not showing these for those of you who are just listening, but they're Pro Marker watercolor pens. They have a brush tip and they have a fine tip. And I really like those. Use them quite a lot. All right, let's talk about paper, because I want us to
swing back into the land of penciledom just for a moment.
Sure.
Because I found that there are two pencils that are, you know, when I recommend that people kind of, you know, get some colored pencils, I suggest that they get a small set of colored pencils. And then I suggest that there are two specific pencils that people pick up that I find are just such game changers. And they're two Winsor & Newton pencils. And one is the black grape color and the other is the grayed lavender color. And they're both kind of muted grayish purples, the black grape being much darker and the grayed lavender being the lighter version of that. And so for putting in, just like if you had a generic kind of go-to, I think I need a shadow. These two colors, they play so well with other colors. You can put in the shadow with black grape and then put blue over it. And there's a shadow in the blue. So for all my dark value things, I'll be dropping that black grape, a lot of it into sort of shadow areas.
Like grape.
Yes, black grape. And the other fun part of that is because on those Prismacolor pencils, the names of the pencils are also in French. You will then be carrying a pencil that says Raisin Noir. Raisin Noir. And that's
Now you just said Prismacolor. I thought it was Winsor & Newton.
No, sorry, Prismacolor. Okay, so Prismacolor pencils.
Winsor & Newton. These are Prismacolor pencils.
I just had probably Winsor & Newton on my mind.
Because I had a lot of Winsor & Newton pencils, and I was like, I don't have anything like that. So
yeah, no. So this is a Prismacolor pencil.
So black grape, and what was the other one?
Grayed lavender. So grayed if I'm putting a shadow in on something that is yellow or really light valued, I will use the grayed lavender, and it plays with like very nicely with yellows. You know, it doesn't turn them muddy. It doesn't turn them green. It
Payne's gray is such a great universal. Yeah,
when you mentioned Payne's gray and kind of loving. By the way, was the Payne's gray? So the Payne's gray that's the watercolor marker, the Pro Marker.
Pro Marker does Pro Marker.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go geek out with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And but these are my two suggestions for, because also with this black grape one, if you like to just sort of pick up a Prismacolor pencil and make a sketch with it,
right?
And you usually do that with black. Well, you can do that with black grape, and then it's blackish, but it's also got this little bit of purple to it. So it just looks really cool. And then you can go over that and drop other colors in it. It will turn into good sort of background depth, dark colors. So you can essentially make a value sketch with it and then colorize that as sort of an easy approach to painting or drawing with your colored pencils.
Right. So we're kind of long, but I think this is interesting. I was thinking like we could probably just do like a huge series. We could probably do an entire podcast about art supplies, which we're not going to do. But here's another art supply.
We can come back to it like later on.
Possibly.
We
can come back to it. So another thing I really like, I like drawing inks. I like to paint with those. I like to paint with, I used to use Dr. P.H. Martin's transparent watercolors, which are like liquid watercolors that come in a bottle with this eyedropper. Now I'm very into the Winsor & Newton drawing inks, which you can use similarly, really intense colors. And you can use them like we were talking with watercolor. Can put that down as your base, and then you can put colored pencil on top of it. Another thing I also like a lot is Sumi ink, which is a Japanese ink. It comes in liquid form, but it also comes in these beautiful blocks. It's like a solid wood block, yeah. And that's another thing I used to carry around with me in my pocket when I just had like the jeans pocket thing, because you take that and you can literally rub it on the sidewalk. And take your water brush, and you can use the sidewalk as a little palette. And Sumi ink is like a solid block of ink, but it's also, to me, it has a really nice quality. It's like slightly warmer than India ink. It is and you can really dilute it and get it to be very, very faint and just layer and layer and layer it on. So some of the ink can just be like too aggressive. Ink can just kind of ruin the party by being super black.
Kind of loud. Behave like phthalo blue.
Right. Yeah. But exactly. But Sumi ink is just, you know, it's dignified and gentle, and it's really nice. And you can also use that with a dip pen or with a brush. So that's,
and I love the thought of you sitting there on the sidewalk with it, kind of grinding a little bit there and dipping into that little puddle that you've made.
That's part of what I like about urban sketching is just using what's there. You know, I've done paintings like using mud or using, you know, like my friend Dan Price, who we talked about last time, he taught me this idea of using the water from the place you are as in your drawing. So like you're, you know, and you can even like, if you're on the beach, you could use salt water and that'll have some effect on your art supplies too. You know, that making, you know, or if you're in a cafe, use a glass of wine to paint with, you know, that use your coffee to paint with, that is part of the process of bringing your you know, your moment into your sketchbook. So let's talk about sketchbooks. I know that you are a producer of sketchbooks, among other things.
Sketchbook. I wanted to kind of try to put features that I thought were really useful. It's just sort of like the sketch bag. There are certain sketchbooks that, so I will alternate between the one that I made, and there's a few others that I'll mention that are also available. But I wanted something that would be relatively small size, but not too small. So I always recommend people go as large with your journal as you will realistically regularly bring in with you into the field, because you can then spread more ideas out on a bigger page. But if it then gets so big that you just don't have it with you, then the journal that you have is better than the one that you don't. So I wanted rounded corners. I wanted a little wind band to prevent the pages from flopping around. I wanted paper that would take watercolor really well. I wanted toned paper as well as white paper. I also wanted to have resource sheets in the back with some tips on drawing, on drawing and also thinking like a naturalist. So how, you know, having a ruler, you know, built into the journal so you can go like, oh, this is this many centimeters long. Or tools to help you estimate percent cover or degrees of arc across the sky. That's sort of the science geek in me wanting to look for ways to quantify things. And it's kind of gets your brain also then to look at whatever phenomenon you're playing with in a slightly different way. So that little journal I find, also I wanted an index in the back so you can number your pages and then say, you know, page this through this, this was when I was in Tanzania, and this through this, this is this. And, you know, here's where you're going to find the warthog. And then the cover, one that you can draw and paint on to, in addition to the pages on the inside of the journal, as you're kind of going along, you, every once in a while, you're doodling or drawing on the outside cover of it. Then the cover of the journal also becomes kind of an index of what's inside.
Fantastic. I like the index a lot too. That's a cool feature. And do you also have a little envelope in the back to put stuff in?
I thought of doing that, but then the cost increase in the book to put in the envelope.
Oh, really?
I was thinking like for that, you know, somebody really wants an envelope. They're better off gluing in their own than spending this much money to have me glue in an envelope for them.
That's good. Because that's like the one feature that you do see in a lot of sketchbooks now is like the little envelope that you put stuff in. I don't know what people put in. I put in like ephemera usually from the trip. Yeah. I also like
putting, at least from my experience in trying to get the journal right, is that putting in the envelope raised the production price of the thing to kind of a nuisance level. And so I decided not to have that feature. But that was something that I originally wanted. The other favorite sketchbooks, I prefer hardbound sketchbooks to spiral bound ones.
Yeah, definitely.
But the toned paper ones that Strathmore makes, they make these gray and brown toned paper ones. Oh, those are fun.
Yeah, I've had a lot of those. That whole series, that line of the sort of soft cover ones are nice too. You know, it's like they're not, they're still kind of squidgy. They're not, it's not like a cheap thing. Do you know the ones I'm talking about? They're almost like a leathery sort of. Mm-hmm. Those are nice. And they have a watercolor one that's really nice in that series. Hanamura also makes a cappuccino and the gray that are really nice hardbound books. I also like the Fabriano's Venezia, which has had this kind of red and white cover. Really nice books with...
So it sort of looks like little bricks on it.
Little bricks with like a red...
Yeah, that is such fine. Gorgeous paper in that thing.
So really nice, like really solid watercolor paper. I've filled dozens of those, and it comes in three or four different sizes. That is really nice. I like... Yeah, I mean, I've also made books. Have you ever done that? Do you ever bind your own book?
No, I never have. For a while, I was using these things where I would take paper, I would punch it with a comb binding, and I had something called a Comtrack in spiral notebook where I would put a little curled plastic coil through, clip those together.
And they'll do that for you too.
Yes, that's right. They'll punch it all for you.
Yeah, I mean, I when I first started doing sketchbooks, the bookness of it was really important. And I was fascinated. I'd always been fascinated by bookbinding. And there really weren't, there was like, you know, those ones we used to have in high school that were like black and they had this sort of not very good white paper in it. That was sort of like the every creative kid carried around those black kind of, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And they still make those, but that was kind of like, that was sort of it. There wasn't really watercolor sketchbooks much. And so I started taking classes in bookbinding and I learned how to bind books, and I would make my own covers and use like marbleized paper and do end papers and stuff like that. And I would make special ones for certain trips. Like I did one to Death Valley and I made a map of Las Vegas and that area. And I burned it a bit and I bound that into be the end papers and stuff.
Oh, that's fun. And did that have the crashed airplane in it?
That's the one with the crashed airplane.
That's a good journal. That's great.
Yeah, and I also, at one point, I met a guy who was an old bookbinder, and he used to do just really, he would like do work for libraries, where like he would bind all the magazines, you know, like when you go to the library and they have all the bound things. So he would do that kind of thing. And I said to him, could you make me like the ultimate sketchbook? And he was like, sure, whatever you want. So I ended up having this sketchbook that was, had like 10 different kinds of paper in it, like different, it had some like really heavy watercolor paper. It had some tone paper, all this different paper. And then it was bound. It was in red kind of simulated leather with the number, I think it was like my 43rd sketchbook at that point. So it was debossed in gold letters on the outside. It was big and chunky. It was about 2 inches thick and I barely used it. It was like too good. And it was too big.
Isn't that interesting?
It was like if somebody had given me a Ferrari and I was like, yeah, I'll drive it like three times, but I'm not really going to drive it to work.
Right. And isn't, I think that happens to a lot of us that will sometimes we invest in even some art supplies, like the really, this is the palette. This is the brush. This is the journal. But then it becomes kind of precious.
Too good to use.
And too good to use. And it's now kind of a fetish instead of being a tool.
That's true. It's true. It's like people who, you know, I mean, I think it's true in every category that there are things that are like, you know, like when... There was a guy. Oh yeah, do you remember the movie The 40-Year-Old Virgin? Where this
I didn't see it.
Well, Steve Carell, like among his geekiness, is he collects action figures, and they're like these action figures that are in the original packaging. You know that whole phenomenon, like right, you never touch it, you never open it. You know, you have records that you never play, and all that kind of stuff. And it's possible in the world of sketchbooking to fall into that. You know, like, and I've had people say that to me, like I bought a really cool sketchbook, but I'm afraid to use it, or I'm not good enough to use it yet.
Yeah.
Or similarly, like buying, you know, a set of like really good watercolors and, you know, it's nonsense. I mean, I think we should wrap this up, but I was going to say, like, I think, and this might be an ironic way to wrap it up, is to say, in the end, art supplies don't really matter. You know,
I agree.
It doesn't really matter what you use. You can use that Motel 6 pen. You can use it on, like, you know, Xerox paper. You can use your kids' crayons. You can, it, what really matters in the end is using it. Don't hoard art supplies. Yeah. They're making more of them all the time. They're not really that expensive if you think about them. Even the most expensive set of watercolors is, you know, $150, let's say, for a really great set of watercolors. It's going to last you for 5 years. You know, it, in the end, it's not, none of this stuff is particularly expensive, but it's also not important. It's really, it's what matters is doing it, making stuff, drawing as often as possible, drawing everything under the sun, having your sketchbook as your companion, challenging yourself, pushing into new areas, finding new things to draw, new techniques, new artists to love, but none of the rest of it matters. It's just fun. It's an adjunct to it, but it's not essential. So in other words, you just wasted an hour and a half of your time listening to us talk about art supplies that don't matter.
Well, it does matter, I'd say, in the point that, you know, sometimes having that tool in your hand that feels really good, it makes a bunch of the logistics easier. You're like, oh, I, you know, if you were trying to do watercolors and you're using the brush that comes in the Prang set, you know, that good luck to you.
Right.
It will be challenging. You know, sometimes having a different tool will make some things a little bit logistically easier. And sometimes kind of, you know, gearing yourself up to go do things also motivates you. But if it then starts to feel precious, then gear gets in the way. And the most important tools are the ones that you use. The most important tools are the ones that you actually have with you. And so just be there with those. And give yourself permission to explore with different media, to play with different sorts of things, to use the mustard in the diner to put the yellow on the breast of the meadowlark. And you'll discover that, you know, some years later, it turns
into a brown. You're talking about your entree, by the way.
And, yeah. but that's kind of fun.
I think that's what we've discovered, interestingly, with cell phones and taking photographs, right? Do you remember when people used to get really fiddly about cameras and all the kind of the right gear to have and all that kind of stuff? And now people take beautiful photographs with their cameras. Their cameras happen to have really great technology, so you can take good pictures. But the most important thing is they're in your pocket and you take pictures all the time. So you take, right. I mean, I think if you said to yourself, you know what, I want to do as much drawing as I do photography, but of course I'm going to do it at the speed of drawing. But, you know, I mean, we all take pictures of everything all the time, just as a souvenir, or as like, oh, this is a beautiful sunset, or, oh, I want to take a picture of that receipt, or, you know, here's a picture of a screw that I need to replace at the hardware store. All those kinds of things, to have that be your attitude towards drawing, I think will make you enjoy drawing that much more. And again, it doesn't really matter what you use. It doesn't matter if you have the perfect camera. What matters is that you took a picture. And Robert Capa, who's a great legendary photographer, he always said, when they asked him, what is the best camera to have? And he said, what's that camera I'm going to use? And he said, the one that you have with you.
It's not the, you know, if you want to make those beautiful pictures, the secret is to make lots of pictures. Same with the photographs. Right. You know, Ansel Adams took lots of crummy photographs, lots of photographs. And then you're able to choose from those and say, like, look, this is the one I'm going to put up on the wall.
Exactly.
Pencil miles.
Pencil miles, right. Exactly. So, all right, cool. Well, good. Well, this has been fun. We've managed to delve deep into yet another subject of potential interest. I don't know. We'll see. But I think, and maybe we'll come back and talk about this some more. I mean, I would say another thing to you, the watcher, the listener, the participant, let us know what you think. Put a comment on YouTube. Let us, or email us. and let us know what you think, because that will help us to do future ones and to give you what you want for us to talk about. We can talk about, obviously, just about anything forever. So help focus us. I think we did pretty well. We stuck on topic.
We did.
We stuck on topic. I'm proud of us for that.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's good. So, all right. Well, until next time, thanks again, John. It was really fun talking to you.
Thank you, Danny. This has been a ball. And all I've right. got also, I know it's not about the stuff, but I'm going to go play with some stuff because you now got me curious about it.
Yeah, we've earned the right, by the way. We've been doing this for a long time, so now we are allowed to play with the stuff. So, in our dotage.
You have two.
Exactly, you have two. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. And remember, visit sketchbookschool.com and claim your free ebook and your monthly newsletter. Our community is always growing, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Art for All.